The title of Khan was attributed, as early as the Middle Ages, to Eastern rulers of Mongolian and Turkish Tatar descent, so that Westerners saw in the mysterious and distant Asian emperor a mythical representation of the king of the world. It was probably based on the phonetic similarity between Khan and Cain that the symbol of the Veltro, the greyhound, was adopted by Antilami and Dante to indicate the avenger who would restore the rights of the empire against the church and the abuses of a degraded and secular political power. The former placed the image of the greyhound in the final part of the Zoophoron surrounding the baptistry of Parma, to indicate the decisive role played by the principle represented by the symbolic animal. The latter saw in the greyhound the one who would hunt down the Guelph she-wolf in every villa. With the short writings that will appear in this series of Quaderni del Veltro, we intend to contribute to compiling an overview of the testimonies and interventions of men and movements animated by a spirit radically different from the modern one, who were protagonists in history and political struggle. In short, we aim to provide documents about the intervention of tradition in history, or, if you prefer, against history, about the phenomenon of opposition to the counterfeiting of the spiritual and warrior principles, about the attempts to impose a political order anchored to real, that is, meta-historical values. Because of their outwardly modern appearance, certain images of the counter-current movement on which we have focused our attention might raise doubts as to whether they are entirely devoid of both meta-historical substance and traditional roots. These images, which a canonical and bigoted traditionalism would label subversive, reveal, in our opinion, if considered not in the superficiality of the motives that express them or in the narrowness of the effects they produce, but in the distant meanings of their causes and ends, that is, of the origins reflected and the directions indicated, a correct and valid spiritual orientation. In our assessment, therefore, the tendencies expressed by the men and historical movements that we will propose are nothing more than different representations and signs, more or less conscious, more or less complete, more or less ordered according to the original archetype, of the idea contained in the Ghibellin Veltro. Julius Evola Franz Altheim, The Religion of Caesar, Quaderni del Veltro, Edizioni di Ipadova, via Patriarchato 34, 1977. According to the morphological scheme of civilization outlined by Oswald Spengler in The Decline of the West, The Agony of Civilization, that is, the terminal phase of a historical cycle, would be characterized by the victory of Caesarism over the world dominated by gold and expressed in the democratic system. Caesarism, which Spengler, in decisive years, saw reappearing in the dictatorial tendencies of interwar Europe, culminates in the figures of great personalities who are designated as Caesarian individuals, exponents of the primacy of the political principle against the abuses of the economy. The advent of Caesarism, wrote Spengler in his main work, already completed in its first draft when the Great War broke out, will break the dictatorship of money and its political weapon, democracy. After a long triumph of the cosmopolitan economy and its interests over creative political force, the political aspect of life will prove, despite everything, to be the strongest. The sword will triumph over money, the will of the master will once again bend the will of the predator. We will certainly not deny the positive nature of such a perspective, later defined by Spengler in terms of a Prussian socialism destined to renew the white peoples, and welcomed instead by those peoples of color who have grafted a sober, warrior-like, Spartan ethic onto the new solidarity-based regimes. However, the use of terms derived from the name of Caesar to indicate the power of leaders who, at least in the formulation made in The Decline, sound a little too much like the plebeian tribune or the Renaissance model of a cynical and unscrupulous prince, shows that Spengler missed the sacred dimension of the figure of Caesar and his sovereignty. Prince, shows that Spengler missed the sacred dimension of Caesar's figure and his sovereignty. It is precisely this higher dimension that is outlined in the two articles published in this notebook. While the author of the first article needs no introduction, a few words about Franz Altheim are in order. Franz Altheim, one of the most distinguished contemporary historians of Roman civilization, belongs to that small group of scholars Oswald Spengler, The Decline of the West, Milan 1970, 2nd edition, p. 1416. Of the ancient world who have attempted to remove the mental stratifications of Christian, positivist, and rationalist derivation in order to understand the traditional universe from within, on the basis of its myths and symbols. Among his works, translated into various languages, we mention Roemische Religions Geschichte, Rom Uno Italien, Geschichte der Lateinischen Sprache, Terra Mater, Das Reich gegen Mitternacht, Italien Uno Dorisque Wanderung, Der Unbesieged Goethe. On the Regnum and the Spirituality of Caesar, precisely because the subject is, as they say, in vogue in Italy today, few of the numerous new works dedicated to Julius Caesar are of any real value. In such circumstances, most are inclined to treat this or similar subjects more for reasons of convenience and almost opportunism than out of a spontaneous interest, felt and supported by serious preparation and understanding. Another of the shortcomings of most modern works on Caesar stems from the application of an exclusively humanist point of view. The so-called cult of personality, the concentration of all interest on the simply human side of the great figures of the ancient world, almost taking as a principle for their understanding the type of the Renaissance condottiero, all this constitutes La Vita Italiana, 44, 10, October 1934. A prejudice that is indeed limiting, if not downright contaminating. Caesar is among those who suffer most from this, precisely because some of his traits lend themselves particularly to striking the imagination of those who are already inclined to do so, while other characteristics, superpersonal and, we might say, fateful, are overshadowed. The formula "personalities make history" is as true when placed in its proper context and contrasted with a deterministic view of a lesser, materialistic or sociological nature, as it is dangerous when taken further, to the point of precluding the penetration of that aspect of great historical figures according to which they appear to us, if not as instruments, at least as elements in a higher order, in a development which, like that of all greatness, cannot be explained by purely human factors. A consideration of the figure of Julius Caesar that starts from this point of view, distancing itself from the usual humanistic, political, military, and literary evaluation, would indeed be highly desirable in the new Italian cultural climate. These reflections came to mind when reading a new work on Caesar by Giovanni Costa. We cannot provide a review of the book here, as this would be rather trivial. As a direct reference to it, we will therefore limit ourselves to saying that it is a clear, balanced, concise and accessible account of the life and work of Caesar, an account that is, however, somewhat marred by a certain rationalist forma mentis on the part of the, who is constantly anxious to go beyond what the so-called positive data can establish and to make adequate use of everything that, as tradition and myth, can be dismissed as lacking historical truth in the vulgar sense. Precisely because of this, it rises to the value of certain testimony for meanings of a higher order, which alone are capable of introducing us to the inner, and therefore more essential, side of a given reality. In this way, this new work, if it is free from rhetorical embellishments, letterizing, and ostentatious apologies, if it appears dignified and testifying to the thoughtfulness of a scholar, does not itself escape, with regard to Caesar, the aforementioned Caio Giulio Cesare, La Vita e l'Opera, ed. Morpurgo. Rome 1934, pp. 183. Humanism, which sometimes intertwines with a vein of skepticism, somewhat diminishing its stature. Yet the book opens with an approach that suggests that the author has immediately taken the right path, that Costa has succeeded in grasping the central point that would allow us to order the essential features of Caesar's character, actions, and function in a reference that is not simply historical, but historical and at the same time superhistorical. Costa begins with the speech that Caesar gave as a teenager at the funeral of Gaius Marius' wife, as a descendant of the ancient, glorious, and almost legendary gens Julia. On that occasion, Caesar uttered these fateful words: "In my lineage there is the majesty of kings, who excel in power among men, and the sacrilege of the gods, who have the power of kings in their hands." Costa sees here the emergence of a principle, both new and ancient, that already resounds like an alarming bell in the turbulent, treacherous, disintegrated, and liberalizing environment of Roman society in the last century before Christ, almost a prelude to the work of the future ruler. But already in the reference to that formula passed to the simple imperator, which in the language of the time designated the mere military leader, is already outdated, and an evident and meaningful connection is established with a traditional and primordial idea, already embodied in some aspects of the ancient Rome of the kings, but, beyond that, universal, because it can be found, in one form or another, in a typical cycle that encompasses the greatest hierarchical spiritual civilizations of the pre-antique world. This idea is already that of the sacrum imperium, of the regnum that justifies itself as an institution that is not only temporal, but temporal and at the same time sustained and made transcendent by a force or influence from above. But Costa seems to have been afraid to touch on this point, which is ripe for a higher interpretation, so that we immediately see him intent on diminishing its significance, above all because he is unable to connect Caesar's idea with anything other than supposed Hellenic-Asian reminiscences, and then burning abundant grains of incense to positivist prejudices about the fables, stories, and amusing adventures that are supposed to be the symbolic ancient traditions about the superhistorical origins of Rome. In this way, Costa set out to do the opposite of what, from our point of view, that is, to consider Caesar in terms of a fatal, superpersonal fulfillment of the idea of the regnum, which initially revealed itself instinctively and almost unconsciously in a moment of eloquence on the part of the young patrician, and later acted as an objective force of destiny through humanity and military action of Caesar, finally becoming conscious of itself and conscious of the perpetual dictator in the new Roman constitution. However, it is extremely significant that, despite his intentions, Costa arrived more or less at the same point. He describes Caesar as a kind of positivist anti-clerical avant la lettre, who nevertheless, through the affirmation of his powerful personality, ends up believing in something more than this simple human personality, certainly not in external deities or in Syrian Semitic redeemers, but in a mystical, mysterious force of luck and victory, Felicitas Caesarus, Fortuna Caesarus, which gradually became evident to him as the hidden soul or subterranean source of everything that was being created through him in the visible world. Such a force, in its personification as Venus Victrix and Venus Genetrix, was placed by Caesar in the closest connection with the primordial generative force of his own lineage, which means that it appeared to him in connection with the same principle to which the young Caesar had referred when he proclaimed the aforementioned doctrine of the regnum, and almost as the concrete effectiveness of this principle in Romanity and in the world. Moreover, if Costa discovers a unity of intent and will behind the variety, often contradictory, if not Machiavellian and opportunistic, yet constantly subordinate to a formula, the dignity of Caesar himself and the dignity of the Roman people, of the means or immediate ends chosen by Caesar in the various phases of his rise, then the same motif can be discerned here, namely, the parallelism of two series, one dominated by the person and the other by a higher principle, from which the person element is, so to speak, acted upon in a preliminary phase, but in which it is ultimately transfigured and centered. To say that Caesar, who is not a believer, not only in the formalistic sense of the Romans, but not even in the broad religious sense that moderns might recognize in him, and who also dispenses with devout or speculative hypotheses about the immortality of the soul, almost through a sensation, gave new life to the ancient primitive idea of Roman fortune, a cosmic and impersonal element, the sole actress, especially in matters of war, and that this was the only conception which, once formed in him, had such a tenacious hold on him that in the last period of his life one made out whether he had so transfused it into himself and so confused it with his own fate that he considered himself, as many believed him to be, divine, divine, repeating that in Caesar, however, this is combined with the personal element that we usually find in all men of genius, who feel the demonium feverishly stirring within them, to the point of objecting to it and making it the reason for a kind of exaltation from which they necessarily draw energy and faith for the accomplishment of their own work. Therefore, with the progress of his fortune in war, one could follow the maturing and fulfillment of this conception of his, as a belief and an explanation that gradually seems to be abstracted from Caesar's person and events, so that both he and his contemporaries saw something inexplicable in which they believed the aura of the numinous to pass. To say all this is to note, albeit through reticence and hesitation and with the usual limitations and pseudo-psychological and empirical explanations that are de rigueur among modern historians and researchers, precisely the element of fatefulness mentioned above, which we do not understand as a generic sensation, but understood in connection with the very principle of the regnum, in the act of giving shape to a new universal civilization through Roman power. Caesar is the one who, in reference to a figure who was certainly not of the first rank, such as Cicero, could say that it was a greater glory to extend the boundaries of the spiritual empire than that of any conqueror, expander of the material empire, and Caesar is at the same time the one who in his style has nothing mystical or vague, whose essentiality and lucidity more than that of a spiritualist or a man of letters, is that of a scientist or a man of action. Caesar is the man who harbors a revolutionary indifference to omens and sacrifices, and he is the man who, at the same time, from the affirmation of his personality directly translated into terms of objective and victorious action, grasps, as has been said, in contrast to an external and priestly fatalism, the sensation of a fatalism of a higher and imminent nature, overshadowed by the strength of his origins, overshadowed by the strength of his origins. Those who understand these elements in a synthesis come closer to the secret of Caesar's character and, through him, to that of the Western hero par excellence. In such a hero there is something Doric in terms of personality, clarity, essentiality, action, but all this is not exhausted in the humanistic, in the purely profane. Already Greek civilization recognized its heroic ideal neither in the tyrant drawing his power from the obscure substance of the demos or from ephemeral personal prestige, nor in the Titanic and Promethean type, but rather in the type of the victor symbolically allied with the Olympians, in Heracles. Such an ideal can place itself beyond both the mystical and the priestly in the strict sense, and reach, in its own specific way, a higher plane, a certain transcendence and fatefulness, through the point where, according to the formula already used, the extreme limit of being personality becomes one with tessa rather than personality. The principle of the regnum, which through Caesar created, so to speak, the elementary physical, political and psychological social conditions for its incarnation and universal affirmation, syncopated by the tragic end of the great emperor, had to reaffirm itself and unfold also in a directly spiritual sphere through a veritable reform of the Roman cult with Caesar Augustus. Here we cannot develop considerations aimed at establishing the secret ideal continuity that runs between these two figures of Romanity, a continuity that is usually not understood precisely because in Caesar only the aspect of the dictator and military leader, or imperator, is usually emphasized in a distorted way. This would therefore be one of the most fascinating subjects for those with the right mindset and doctrinal preparation to deal with it, precisely in accordance with the principle of the regnum. The eternity of the Roman Empire would come to light, not in the terms of a glorifying saying, but in reference to an idea that, rather than historical, that is, arising from the contingent and the perishable, is metaphysical and, as such, endowed with perennial life and the dignity of always and everywhere in the face of a fundamental meaning of civilization as virile spirituality. J. A. Voller Caesar. Caesar's religion has not yet received the consideration it deserves. The position he took towards the state religion, insofar as it was dictated by political motives, can be left aside. We arrive at what was most personal and specific in his attitude only when we study the relationship that Caesar conceived between himself and the force or divinity that in classical antiquity was called Fortune or Tyche. In the commentaries, in comparison with the rest, expressions concerning Fortune are frequent. It is a characteristic of this entity, says Caesar, to take pleasure in sudden changes. In the Spanish campaign of 49, in the space of a few days, the situation changed greatly, fortune turned against him. But it changed again, and the situation was reversed once more. This time, however, it was favorable to Caesar, who did not hesitate to take advantage of it. Not long-term calculations, but seizing the moment, was the key to Caesar's success. Monarchia, number 1, April 1956. Was favorable to Caesar, who did not hesitate to take advantage of it. It was not long-term calculations but seizing the moment and exploiting every possibility in an infallible and extreme way that was characteristic of Caesar. Things went similarly before Dithachium. On this occasion, Caesar says that fortune has even greater power in war than in any other circumstance. It causes the greatest effects to proceed from insignificant causes. This is how Caesar's reversal is explained. He tells his soldiers that fortune has snatched from him a victory that was already assured. But when the dice thrown do not show a good score, one must help Fortuno with one's own effort. This is noteworthy. But at first glance, it would seem to stand alone. In general, Caesar places himself completely aside as a person. For example, he does not speak of his own Fortuna. On the contrary, Fortuna not only helped him, but also caused him harm. In a letter to Pompey, he says that both he and Pompey can testify to what Fortuna can do, given the reversals they have suffered. However, one can take advantage of Fortuna when she is favorable, or let her slip away, one can obtain her approval. Yet Caesarus's fortune was, in Rome, a well-defined concept. Plutarch says that the Romans bowed before Tyche when they were in danger. Yet that of Fortuna Caesarus was a well-defined concept in Rome. Plutarch says that the Romans bowed before Caesar's Tyche. Cicero uses this concept in his speeches for Q. Ligarius and Diodorus in such a way that one gets the impression that he did so with Caesar's approval. Diodorus' accusers claimed that it was Caesar's fortuna that saved him in the alleged assassination attempt against him, as in many other cases. Even stranger is what Cicero says in his speech for Marcellus, delivered in the same year. He repeatedly refers to Caesar's fortuna, while describing the civil war as a fatum. But Caesar, despite being a favorite of fortune, cannot rise above her. In his victories, it is she who can be credited with the main part. Although she is the mistress of human affairs, fortune, in the case of the mercy granted to Marcellus, gives way to Caesar. This action must be attributed solely to Caesar's glory. For true glory and greatness of soul are gifts not of fortune, but of virtue. The words that Caesar himself addressed to the pilot frightened by the fury of a storm have been handed down: "You carry Caesar and Caesar's fortune, who travels with you." Here he himself speaks of his Tyche. These are words in which he expresses his awareness of being an exceptional nature. A second saying of an opponent has also been handed down to us as a sign of Caesar's arrogance. Here he himself speaks of his Tyche. These words express his awareness of being an exceptional person. A second saying of an adversary has also been handed down to us as a sign of Caesar's arrogance. When a soothsayer predicted to Caesar, shortly before his end, that disaster was approaching, he replied that the future would be auspicious because he wanted it to be so. Did Caesar believe he could control the future and destiny? Here is the image that presents itself to us. The clearest and most expansive mind that history has perhaps ever known feels bound to fortune. This encounter between the most antithetical elements defines Caesar's character and what was unique about him. Fortune, together with the ability to recognize and exploit it, this was the secret of Caesar's success, according to his own thinking. Plutarch speaks of the great demon that was his own while he was alive and remained faithful to him even after his death, as the avenger of his murder. Sulla had already been a worshipper of fortune, the Praenestine fortune. But at the same time, he referred to Felicitas, which in Roman terms meant lasting and certain fortune. If his nickname Felix was translated into Greek as Epaphroditos, this means that Sulla felt constantly protected by Venus. In him, as in Caesar, we see a personal relationship between man and the divine. Cicero repeatedly emphasizes Caesar's exceptional nature and extols his almost divine wisdom, his divine virtus. He calls him like a god and speaks of his eternity. Like Sulla, Caesar felt that there was a special relationship between himself and Venus, the ancestor of his people. But this meant going a step further than risking association with a deity whose essence consists in sudden changeability, instead of relying on the constancy of Felicitas. A contemptuous saying about Pompey's Felicitas has been handed down to us from Caesar. How much more clearly he was able to grasp reality and how much more confident he was in himself than any of his predecessors. Sulla must have attributed to his Venus the ability to bind good fortune to himself permanently. but in a very different key, he must have perceived the unique and extraordinary event linked to Fortuna, he who considered himself the nephew of Venus, without however claiming to be an Epaphroditos himself. Moreover, Fortuna Caesarus associated herself with Fortuna Republici, that is, with the same principle referred to the state. Here too, Caesar went beyond the world with his particular claim, without the pretension of being himself an Epaphroditos. Moreover, Fortuna Caesarus was associated with Fortuna Republici, that is, with the same principle referring to the state. Here too, Caesar, with his particular claim, took himself beyond the world in which the Romans had lived until then. For the first time, he no longer found himself in the republican state and denied its general right. In this too, he differed from Sulla. According to Caesar, the republic was nothing, a mere name without body or form. Sulla would not have understood his own task when he renounced the dictatorship. It has been said that Sulla's spiritual homeland was the individualistic way of life of the feline and the quiet life of a private citizen, which, at the end of his life, took the place of public activity. Perhaps this interpretation is too simplistic. One thing is certain, however, Caesar felt it necessary to dominate the political scene until his last breath. As he said, his words were law. It is understandable that, faced with this, Cicero recalled the fragility of all that is human. The eternal res publica, he pointed out, now hangs on the life of a mortal. The public honors bestowed on Caesar are a tangible sign of this fact. He received and exercised a number of prerogatives and privileges reminiscent of the kings of old. However, he rejected them. The public honors bestowed on Caesar are a tangible sign of this fact. He received and exercised a number of prerogatives and privileges reminiscent of the kings of old. However, he rejected the diadem, contenting himself with exercising the consulate and the dictatorship. Indeed, he wanted this refusal to be recorded in the fasti, thus making it definitive. Nevertheless, he accepted cult honors that made him appear greater than any human being. He did not even reject the divine veneration of his person. It has been emphasized that the fundamental factor here was Caesar's personality, his particular awareness of himself, and the dignitas he claimed for himself. All the honors bestowed upon him referred to his person. They were like attempts to interpret the problem posed by his very existence. Insofar as they expressed the fact that Caesar, in his humanity and authority, towered above the entire Roman nobility, he accepted them as a completely natural recognition, and his attitude in receiving such honors suggested that he did not feel elevated because of them, but that he believed he was merely receiving what was evident to his innate nature. Everywhere, whether in relation to fortune or in the face of the state religion, Caesar always tended toward the extraordinary, the superhuman. The adaptation of the form of the state and the empire to the stature of the great personality finds its counterpart in the domain of religion. When, later, Caesar's adopted son rose to power as his heir, similar problems arose. It would seem that at this point all the previous developments came to their ultimate conclusion. Once again, a dominion was established that went beyond what was simply human, and now we also find the designation that adequately expresses the fundamental idea, Augustus. According to Cassius Dio's exegesis, this title designates that which transcends the human. Yet there was a difference between Caesar and Augustus. It is not only to be noted that Augustus wanted to be a second Romulus, a new founder of Rome. Augustus, moreover, never spoke of his own fortuna. His lord was Apollo, the god of measure, who exhorted men to recognize their limits. No one could ever speak of Augustus' arrogancier. Of course, he too claimed an exceptional position for himself. But he possessed it not by virtue of his innate nature, but because of the recognition accorded to him by his grateful fellow citizens, something that would have been inconceivable for Caesar. He could never have uttered, like Caesar, the arrogant saying that men had as law what he said. In every respect, Augustus bound himself to the existing reality and accepted it in order to take it further. Thanks to new laws, presented at my suggestion, I have brought back to mind many models offered by our predecessors that had disappeared in our generation, and I myself have passed on to posterity many models to be imitated, he declared in giving an account of what he had done. Caesar was proud of his potentia and gloria, where potentia expresses actual power. Augustus, on the other hand, always and only speaks of his potestos, that is, the legitimate power that derived from his office. Necessarily, a different image of the state and the empire had to take shape under him. We will mention only the fundamental features of this image here. What remained, what was inevitable, was the domination of a great individuality. The future and the reorganization of the state, of the Res Publica, now depended on this. But to be so great, this great individuality had to detach itself from everything that was merely its personal tendency, it had to present itself to the world as a binding law on a universal plane. Was this requirement fulfilled in Caesar? In truth, Caesar remained more of an extraordinary being than one who acted in a fruitful and happiness-generating manner, more like a power towering above all others than one who knew how to inspire inner commitment. He did not stand at the center of the state, of the Res Publica, but at its side. The insertion of the domineering personality into the state, this, and nothing else, represented Augustus. Franz Altheim.